of Africa, Asia, Oceania, and the Americas, and wound up in an entirely different world from the galleries of classical European paintings. Luoji pointed out the sculptures, paintings, and old documents from Asia and Africa, and said, "These were taken by an advanced civilization from a backward one. Some were looted, others were stolen or defrauded. But look at them now. They're all well preserved. Even during the Second World War, these objects were transferred to a safe place." They stood before a Dunhuang mural, sealed in a glass case. "Think about how much turmoil and war that land of ours has seen since the time Abbot Wang gave these to the Frenchmen. If the murals were left there, can you be certain they would have been this well preserved?"
"But will the Trisolarans preserve humanity's cultural heritage? They have no regard for us at all."
"Because they said we're bugs? But that's not what that means. Yan Yan, do you know what the greatest expression of regard for a race or civilization is?"
"No. What?"
"Annihilation. That's the highest respect a civilization can receive. They would only feel threatened by a civilization they truly respect." They passed silently through the 24 galleries housing Asian art, walking through the distant past while imagining a gloomy future. Without realizing it, they reached the Egyptian Antiquities Gallery. "Do you know who I'm thinking of here?" Luoji stood beside a glass case containing the golden mask of a mummified pharaoh and tried out a lighter topic of conversation. "Sophie Marceau."
"Because of Belphegor, Phantom of the Louvre, right? Sophie Marceau is gorgeous. She's got Eastern looks, too."
For some reason, right or wrong, Luoji sensed traces of jealousy and offense in her voice. "Yan Yan, she's not as beautiful as you. That's the truth." He also wanted to say, "One might be able to find her beauty among these works of art, but yours eclipses them." But he didn't want to come off as sarcastic. The hint of a shy smile flitted across her face like a cloud, the first time he had seen this smile he remembered from his dreams.
"Let's go back to the oil paintings,"
she said softly. They returned to the Hall Napoleon, but forgot which entrance to use. The most visible signs pointed to the three jewels of the palace: the Mona Lisa, Venus de Milo, and Winged Victory. "Let's see the Mona Lisa," he suggested. As they headed in that direction, she said,
"Our teacher said that after he visited the Louvre, he was a little disgusted with the Mona Lisa and Venus de Milo."
"Why was that?"
"Because tourists come for those two objects, but have no interest in less famous but equally great works of art."
"I'm one of the great uncultured." They arrived at the mysterious smile, which was behind a thick wall of protective glass, and much smaller than Luoji had imagined. Even Zhuang Yan didn't seem particularly excited.
"Seeing her reminds me of all of you," she said, pointing at the figure in the painting.
"All of us?"
"The wall facers, of course."
"What's she got to do with the wall facers?"
"Well, I wonder, and this is just speculation, so don't laugh. I wonder whether we could find a form of communication that only humans can comprehend, but which the Sophons never will. That way, humanity can be free of Sophon monitoring."
Luoji looked at her for several seconds, and then stared at the Mona Lisa. "I get what you mean. Her smile is something that the Sophons and the Trisolarans we'll never understand."
"That's right. Human expressions, and people's eyes in particular, are subtle and complex. A gaze or a smile can transmit so much information, and only humans can understand that information. Only humans have that sensitivity."
"True. One of the biggest problems in artificial intelligence is identifying facial and eye expressions.
Some experts even say that computers may never be able to read the eyes.
So is it possible to create a language of expressions and then speak with the face and the eyes?
Luoji thought this over seriously, then shook his head with a smile. He pointed at the Mona Lisa. We can't even read her expression. When I stare at her, the meaning of her smile changes every second and never repeats itself.
Zhuangyan jumped up and down excitedly, like a child.
But that means that facial expressions really can convey complex information.
And if the information is, the spacecraft have left Earth, destination Jupiter, how would you convey that using facial expressions?
When primitive man began to speak, surely it was only to convey simple meanings. It may even have been less complex than bird calls. Language gradually grew in complexity after that.
Well, let's try to convey a simple meaning through facial expressions.
Okay.
She nodded her head excitedly.
Here, let's each think of a message, and then exchange them.
Luoji paused for a moment. I've thought of mine. Zhuangyan thought for a much longer time, and then nodded.
Then let's begin.
They stared at each other, but held that pose for less than half a minute before they burst out laughing at practically the same instant.
My message was, tonight I'd like to invite you to have supper on the Champs-Élysées, he said.
She doubled over with laughter.
Mine was, you need to shave.
These are grave matters concerning the fate of humanity, so we ought to remain serious,
Luoji said, holding in his laughter.
This time, no laughing allowed, she said,
as serious as a child redefining the rules of a game. They stood back to back, each thinking of a message, and then turned around and locked eyes once again. Luoji felt the urge to laugh and strove to suppress it, but the task soon became much easier, for Zhuangyan's clear eyes had begun to pluck at his heartstrings again. And so it was that the wall-facer and the young woman stood, gazes locked, in front of the smile of Mona Lisa in the Louvre, in the dead of night. The dam in Luoji's soul had sprung a tiny leak, and this trickle eroded it, expanding the tiny fissure into a turbulent stream. He grew afraid and strove to patch the crack in the dam, but was unable to. A collapse was inevitable. Then he felt like he was standing on a towering clifftop, and the girl's eyes were the vast abyss beneath, covered in a pure white sea of clouds. But the sun shone down from all directions and turned the clouds into a brilliance of color that surged endlessly. He felt himself sliding downward, a very slow slide, but one he could not arrest under his own power. In a panic, he shook his limbs to try and find a place to hold on. But beneath his body was nothing but slick ice. His slide accelerated until finally, with a burst of vertigo, he began to fall into the abyss. In an instant, the joy of falling reached the upper limit of pain. The Mona Lisa was deforming. The walls were deforming, melting like ice as the Louvre collapsed, its stones turning to red-hot magma as they fell. When the magma passed over their bodies, it felt cool as a clear spring. They fell with the Louvre, passing through a melted Europe toward the center of the Earth. And when they reached it, the world around them exploded in a shower of gorgeous cosmic fireworks. Then the sparks extinguished, and in the twinkling of an eye, space became crystal clear. The stars wove crystal beams into a giant silver blanket, and the planets vibrated, emitting beautiful music. The starfield grew dense like a surging tide. The universe contracted and collapsed, until at last, everything was annihilated in the creative light of love.
"We need to observe Trisolaris right now," General Fitzroy said to Dr. Ringier.
They were in the control room of the Hubble 2 space telescope, a week after its assembly was completed.
"General, I'm afraid that's not possible."
"I have the feeling that the observations in progress right now are actually private work that you astronomers are doing on the side."
"I'd have done my own work if it were possible, but Hubble 2 is still in the testing phase."
"You're working for the military. Carrying out orders is all you need to do."
"No one here is military apart from you. We are following NASA's testing plan."
The general's tone softened.
"Doctor, can't you just use Trisolaris as a test target?"
"Test targets have been carefully selected according to distance and brightness classes, and the test plan has been formulated to be maximally economical, so that the telescope completes all tests after just one rotation. In order to observe Trisolaris now, we would need to rotate through an angle of nearly 30 degrees and back, and spinning this bad boy uses up propellant. We're saving the military money, General."
"Let's have a look at how you're saving it, then. I just found this on your computer,"
Fitzroy said as he brought a handout from behind his back. He held a printout of a photograph, an overhead shot of a group of people looking upward excitedly. They were recognizably the crew from this very control room, Ringier in their midst, along with three women in sexy poses who might have been the girlfriends of some in the group. The location of the photo was evidently the roof of the control room building, and the photo was very clear, as if it had been shot from 10 or 20 meters above. Where it differed from an ordinary photograph was in the complicated numbers overlaid atop it.
"Doctor, you're standing on the highest point of the building. It doesn't have a rocker arm like a movie set, does it? You're telling me that rotating Hubble 2 30 degrees costs money. Well, how much does it cost to rotate it 360 degrees? Because that $10 million investment wasn't made so you could snap photos of you and your girlfriends from space. Should I add that sum to your bill?"
"General, your order must, of course, be carried out,"
Ringier said hastily, and the engineers immediately went to work. Coordinate data was quickly called up from the target database. In space, the enormous cylinder, over 20 meters in diameter and more than 100 meters long, slowly started to turn, panning across the star field displayed on the screen in the control room.
"This is what the telescope sees?" asked the general.
"No, this is just the image returned by the positioning system. The telescope returns still photos that need to be processed before they're viewable."
5 minutes later, the panning stopped. The control system reported that positioning had been achieved, and after another 5 minutes, Ringier said,
"Good. Now return to the test position."
In surprise, Fitzroy asked,
"What? Is it done?"
"Yes. Now the images are being processed."
"Can't you take a few more?"
"General, we've captured 210 images at multiple focal lengths."
At that moment, the first observation image finished processing, and Ringier pointed to the screen.
"Look, General, there's the enemy world you want to see so badly."
Fitzroy saw nothing but a group of three halos against a dark background. They were diffuse, like streetlights through fog. These were the three stars that would decide the fate of two civilizations.
"So we really can't see the planet."
Fitzroy couldn't hide his disappointment.
"Of course we can't. Even when the 100-meter Hubble 3 is finished, we'll only be able to observe Trisolaris at a very few set positions, and we'll only be able to make it out as a dot, with no detail at all."
"But there's something else here, Doctor. What do you think this is?"
asked one of the engineers, pointing to a spot close to the three halos. Fitzroy leaned in but saw nothing. It was so faint
that only an expert could catch it.
"It's got a diameter larger than a star," an engineer said.
After enlarging the area several times, the thing covered the entire screen.
"It's a brush!"
shouted the general in alarm. The layman always comes up with better names than the expert, which is why when experts name things, they too work from an outsider's perspective. And thus, Brush became the figure's name, because the general's description was accurate. It was a cosmic brush, or to be more precise, a set of cosmic bristles without a handle. Of course, you could also see it as hair standing on end.
"It must be a scratch in the coating. I mentioned in the feasibility study that a paste-up lens would cause problems,"
Ringye said, shaking his head.
"All the coatings have been through stringent testing. A scratch of this sort wouldn't happen, and it's not generated by any other lens flaw either. We've already returned tens of thousands of test images, and it's never come up before,"
said an expert from Zeiss, the lens's manufacturer. A hush fell over the control room. They all gathered to stare up at the image on the screen until it got so crowded that some of them called up the image on other terminals. Fitzroy sensed the change in the room's atmosphere. People who had grown lazy from the fatigue of lengthy tests were anxious now, like they had been hit by a curse that rooted everything in place but their eyes, which grew ever brighter.
"God!"
exclaimed several people at the same time. The frozen formation abruptly turned into excited activity. The snatches of dialogue Fitzroy picked up were a bit too technical for him.
"Any dust around the target's position? Check it."
"No need. I completed that item. Observing the absorption of the background stellar radial movement, there's an absorption peak at 200 millimeters. It may be a carbon microparticle, F-class density."
"Any opinions on the effect of high-speed impact?"
"The wake diffuses along the impact axis, but the diffusion scope... Do we have a model of that?"
"Yes, one moment. Here it is. Impact speed?"
100 times third cosmic velocity.
Is it already that high?"
"That's a conservative figure. For the impact cross-section, use..."
"Right. That's right. That's just about it. Just a rough estimate."
With the experts busy, Ringye stood next to Fitzroy.
"General, can you try your best to count the bristles in the brush?"
The general nodded, and then bent over a terminal and began counting. The computer needed 4 or 5 minutes to complete every calculation, but there were a number of errors, so it was half an hour before the results were ready.
"The wake diffuses the dust to a maximum diameter of 240,000 kilometers, or twice the size of Jupiter,"
the astronomer running the mathematical model said.
"That makes sense," Ringye said.
He raised his arms and looked up at the ceiling, as if looking through it to the heavens.
"And that confirms it."
There was a tremble to his voice. And then, as if to himself, he said,
"So it's been confirmed. Nothing wrong with that."
Silence fell over the control room again, heavy and oppressive this time. Fitzroy wanted to ask a question, but at the sight of the solemn bowed heads, he couldn't open his mouth. After a while, he heard gentle sobs and saw a young man trying to hide his tears.
"Knock it off, Harris. You're not the only skeptic here. It's hard for everyone,"
someone said. The young man, Harris, lifted his teary eyes and said,
"I know skepticism is just a way to comfort myself, but I wanted to live out my life in comfort. God, now I'm not even lucky enough for that."
Silence returned. At last, Ringye remembered Fitzroy.
"General, let me explain. The three stars are surrounded by interstellar dust. Previously, a number of bodies moving at high speed crossed that dust, and their high-speed impact with the dust left behind a wake. The wake continued to expand,
and has now reached a diameter twice that of the planet Jupiter. There are only subtle differences between the wake and the surrounding dust, so they are undetectable at close range. Only here, 4 light-years away, are they observable.
I've counted the bristles. There are about 1,000, General Fitzroy said.
Of course. That number confirms our intelligence reports. General, we're looking at the Tri-Solaran fleet.
Hubble 2's discovery, the final confirmation of the reality of the Tri-Solaran invasion, extinguished the last of humanity's fantasies. The descent of a new round of despair, panic, and confusion ushered the human race into life under the Tri-Solar Crisis. Then the hard times began. With a rocky change of direction, the vehicle of time veered off along a new track. The only constant in a world of tremendous change is the swift passage of time. 5 years passed like a blur. Part 2. The Spell. Year 8. Crisis Era. Distance of the Tri-Solaran fleet from the solar system. 4.20 light-years. Tyler had been jumpy lately. Despite the setbacks, the Mosquito Swarm plan eventually won PDC approval. Development of the space fighters began, but progress was slow due to a lack of advanced technologies. Humanity continued to improve the technology of its Stone Age axes and clubs, chemically propelled rockets. Tyler's supplemental project, the study of Europa, Ceres, and various comets, was odd enough that some people suspected that he had come up with it purely to add a sense of mystery to the overly direct main plan. However, since it could be incorporated into the mainstream defense program, he was allowed to start working on that as well. So Tyler had to wait. He went home and, for the first time in his 5 years as a wallfacer, led the life of a normal person. The wallfacers were subject to increasing scrutiny from the community. Whether they had asked for the role or not, they had been set up in the eyes of the masses as messiah figures. Accordingly, a wallfacer cult sprang up. No matter how many explanations the UN and PDC issued, legends of their supernatural abilities circulated widely and grew increasingly fanciful. In science fiction movies, they were shown as superheroes, and in the eyes of many, they were the sole hope for humanity. This gave the wallfacers an enormous amount of popular and political capital that guaranteed things would go smoothly when they tapped huge amounts of resources. Luoji was the exception. He remained in seclusion, never showing his face. No one knew where he was or what he was doing. One day, Tyler had a visitor. Like the other wallfacers, his home was under heavy guard, and all visitors had to pass stringent background checks. But when he first saw the visitor in the living room, he knew that the man would pass through easily, because it was obvious at a glance that he posed no threat to anyone. On this hot day, he wore a wrinkled suit, a similarly wrinkled tie, and, more annoyingly, the sort of bowler hat no one wore anymore. He evidently wanted to present a more formal appearance for his visit, since he had probably never attended a formal occasion before. Pale and emaciated, he looked malnourished. His glasses sat heavily on his skinny, pale face. His neck hardly seemed able to support the weight of his head, and his suit looked practically empty, as if it was hanging on a rack. As a politician, Tyler saw at a glance that he belonged to one of those mean social classes whose poverty was more spiritual than material. Like Goggle's petty bureaucrats, who, despite their lowly social station, still worry about preserving that status and spend their whole lives engaged in uncreative, exhausting random tasks that they carry out exactingly. In everything they do, they fear making mistakes.
With everyone they meet, they fear causing displeasure, and they dare not take the slightest glance through the glass ceiling to a higher plane of society. Tyler detested those people. They were utterly dispensable, and when he thought about how they made up the majority of the world that he wanted to save, it left a bad taste in his mouth. The man walked gingerly through the living room door, but did not dare venture further. He seemed afraid of marking the carpet with the dirty soles of his shoes. He took off his hat and looked at the master of the house through his thick glasses as he bowed repeatedly. Tyler made up his mind to send him off as soon as he spoke his first sentence, for even if what the man had to say was important to him, to Tyler it was meaningless. In a frail voice, the pitiful man uttered his first sentence. It struck Tyler like a bolt of lightning, and so dazed him that he practically sat down on the ground. Every word was like a thunderclap.
Wohlfahrer Frederick Tyler, I am your wallbreaker.
Who would have thought we'd one day be facing a battle map like this?
Chang Wei-se exclaimed as he looked at a 1-to-1 trillion scale chart of the solar system displayed on a monitor large enough to be a movie screen. It was almost entirely dark, except for the tiny spot of yellow in the center that was the sun. The chart radius reached the middle of the Kuiper Belt. When it was displayed in its entirety, it was like looking down on the solar system from a distance of 50 AU above the ecliptic plane. The chart accurately marked the orbits of planets and satellites, as well as the conditions of known asteroids, and it could display a precise sectional layout of the solar system for any point in the next millennium. Now that positional markings for celestial bodies had been turned off, the chart display was bright enough that you could make out Jupiter if you looked closely enough. It was just an indistinct, tiny, bright spot, but from this distance, the other 7 major planets were invisible.
Yes, we are facing major changes, Zhang Beihai said.
The military had just completed a meeting to assess its first space map, and now only the 2 of them remained in the spacious war room.
Commander, I wonder if you noticed the eyes of our comrades when they saw this map, he said. Of course I noticed. It's understandable. They would have imagined a space map to be like what you find in popular science books. A couple of colored billiard balls rotating around a fireball. It's only when they're faced with one drawn to an accurate scale that they come to an appreciation of the vastness of the solar system. And, whether they're Air Force or Navy, the furthest their air and water craft can go doesn't even amount to 1 pixel on the big screen. It seems that looking at the battlefield of the future did not inspire a stitch of confidence or passion for battle in our comrades. And now we're back to defeatism. Commander, I don't want to talk about the reality of defeatism today. That's a subject for a formal meeting. What I'd like to discuss is... well... He faltered, and smiled. A rare thing for someone who is usually so outspoken. Chang Wei-se turned away from the map and smiled back at him. Seems you've got something highly unorthodox to say.
Yes. Or something unprecedented, at least. I'm making a recommendation.
Proceed. Get right down to the topic. Of course, you don't need encouragement for that.
Yes, Commander. Over the past 5 years, little progress has been made in basic planetary defense and space travel research. The preliminary technology in those 2 programs, controlled nuclear fusion and the space elevator, are still at square one, with no hope in sight, and there are all kinds of problems with higher thrust chemical rockets. If things continue in this vein, then I fear a space fleet, even at the low-tech level, will remain science fiction forever.
You chose high-tech, Comrade Beihai. You ought to be well aware of the rules of scientific research.
Of course, I'm aware of them. Research is a process of leaping forward,
and qualitative change is only produced by long-term quantitative accumulation. Breakthroughs in theory and technology are mostly achieved in concentrated bursts. Still, Commander, how many people understand the problem like I do? It's very likely that in 10 or 20 or 50 years, or even a century, we still won't have any major breakthroughs in any scientific or technical field. And at that point, how far will defeatist thinking have developed? What spiritual and mental state will have taken hold in the Space Force? Commander, am I really taking this too far?
Beihai, what I most admire about you is that you always keep the long term in mind as you work. It's a rare thing among political cadres in this military. Please, go on. Well, I can only speak from the scope of my own work. Working under the above assumptions, what sort of difficulties and pressures will be faced by our future comrades engaged in political and ideological work in the Space Force?
A grimmer question is, how many ideologically qualified political cadres will be left in the forces, added Chang Wei-se. To contain defeatism, we first need to have a firm faith in victory ourselves, but this is certain to be more difficult in your hypothetical future. That's where my worry lies, Commander. When that time comes, political work in the Space Force won't be up to the task.
Your recommendation?
Send reinforcements. Chang Wei-se looked at Zhang Beihai for a few seconds, then turned back to the big screen. He moved the cursor and enlarged the sun until their epaulets reflected the sunlight.
Commander, what I mean is...
He raised a hand.
I know what you mean.
Then he pulled back until the entire map was displayed, plunging the war room back into gloom, and then brought the sun forward again. And again and again, as he thought. Until at last he said,
Has it ever occurred to you that if political and ideological work in the Space Force is a complex and difficult task right now, it will considerably weaken today's work to hibernate the most outstanding political officers and send them to the future?
I realize that, Commander. I'm just voicing a personal suggestion. Big picture thinking is, of course, up to my superiors.
Chang Wei-se stood up and turned on the lights, illuminating the war room.
No, Comrade Beihai. This is a job for you now. Drop everything else. Starting tomorrow, you will focus on the Space Force Political Department, do some research into the other branches, and draft a preliminary report for the Central Military Commission as soon as possible.
The sun was setting behind the mountains when Tyler arrived. Exiting the car, he faced a vision of paradise. The softest light of the day shining on the snow peaks, the lake, and the forest, and Luoji and his family enjoying the otherworldly evening in the grass on the lakeshore. What first caught his eye was the mother, so young-looking, like an older sister to the one-year-old child. From a distance, it was hard to make her out, but as he drew closer, his attention shifted to the child. If he hadn't seen it with his own eyes, he wouldn't have believed that such an adorable little being actually existed. Like a stem cell of beauty, the embryonic state of all that is beautiful. Mother and child were drawing on a large sheet of white paper as Luoji stood off to one side watching with interest, as he had in the Louvre, gazing from a distance at his beloved, now a mother. Moving closer still, Tyler saw in his eyes an infinite bliss, a happiness that seemed to permeate everything between mountain and lake in this Garden of Eden. Having just arrived from the grim outside world made the scene before his eyes feel unreal. He had been married twice, but was now single, and the joys of family had meant little to him in his pursuit of a man's glory. Now, for the first time ever,
he felt he had lived an empty life. Luoji, captivated by his wife and child, only noticed Tyler when he had gotten quite close. Due to the psychological barriers erected by their common situation, there had been no personal contact between Wallfacers up to this point. But having spoken with him on the phone, Luoji showed no surprise at Tyler's arrival and met him with polite warmth. "Madam, please excuse the interruption," Tyler said with a slight bow to Zhuang Yan, who had come over with the child.
"Welcome, Mr. Tyler. We seldom have guests, so we are pleased that you could come."
Her English was strained, but her voice retained a childlike softness, and she still had that cool spring of a smile, which stroked his weary soul like an angel's hands.
"This is our daughter, Xia Xia."
He wanted to hug the child, but was afraid of losing control of his feelings, so he simply said, "Seeing you two angels is worth the trip."
"We'll let you talk. I'll go and prepare dinner,"
she said, as she smiled at the two men. "No, that's not necessary. I just want to have a brief chat with Dr. Luo. I won't take up too much time." Zhuang Yan warmly insisted that he stay for dinner, then left with the child. Luoji motioned for Tyler to sit on a white chair in the grass. When he sat down, his whole body went limp, as if his tendons had been removed. He was a traveler who had at last reached his destination after a long voyage.
"Doctor, it seems like you've been lost to the world for the past 2 years," Tyler said.
"Yes." Luoji remained standing. He swept a hand about him. "This is my everything."
"You are truly a smart man. And at least from one perspective, a more responsible man than me."
"What do you mean by that?" Luoji asked, with a puzzled smile.
"At least you haven't wasted resources."
"So she doesn't watch TV either? I mean, your angel?"
"Her? I don't know.
She's always with Xia Xia these days, so I don't think she watches much."
"Then you really don't know what's happened out there over the past few days?"
"What happened?"
"You don't look well. Are you tired? What can I get you to drink?"
"Anything," Tyler said, watching the last golden rays of the setting sun on the lake dazedly.
4 days ago, my wall breaker appeared."
Luoji stopped pouring the wine, and after a moment's silence said,
"So soon?"
Tyler nodded heavily.
"That's the first thing I said to him, too."
"So soon," Tyler said to the wall breaker. He tried to keep his voice calm, but it ended up sounding feeble.
"I'd liked to have come sooner, but I thought I'd collect more comprehensive evidence, so I'm late. I am sorry,"
the wall breaker said. He stood behind Tyler like a servant and spoke slowly, with a servant's humility. His final sentence even contained a meticulous and thoughtfulness, the understanding that an executioner shows to his victim. Then a suffocating silence took hold. At last, Tyler screwed up the courage to look at the wall breaker, who then asked respectfully,
"Sir, shall I go on?"
Tyler nodded but averted his gaze. He sat down on the sofa and did his best to calm down.
"Thank you, sir."
The wall breaker bowed again, his hat still in hand.
"First, I'll briefly describe the plan you've shown to the outside world. Using a fleet of nimble space fighters carrying 100-megaton class superbombs, your fighters will assist Earth's fleet by executing a suicide strike on the Tri-Solaris fleet. Perhaps I've oversimplified, but that's basically it, right?"
"There's no point in discussing this with you," Tyler said.
He had been considering whether to terminate the conversation. The moment the wall breaker revealed himself,
Tyler's intuition as a politician and strategist informed him that the other man was the victor. But at this point, he would be lucky if his mind had not been laid entirely bare.
"If that's the case, sir, then I don't have to go on, and you can arrest me. But you surely must know that regardless of what happens, your true strategy and all of the evidence used to prove my hypothesis will make the news across the world tomorrow, or maybe even tonight. At the cost of the rest of my life, I stand before you today, and I hope that you will value my sacrifice."
"You may continue," Tyler said with a wave of his hand.
"Thank you, sir. I am truly honored, and I will not use up too much time."
The wall breaker bowed again. A humble respect so rarely seen among modern people seemed to be in his blood, able to manifest at any time, like a noose gradually tightening around Tyler's neck.
"Then, sir, was my rendition of your strategy just now correct?"
"It was."
"It was not," the wallbreaker said. "Sir, pardon my saying it, but it was not correct."
"Why?"
"Given humanity's technological capabilities, the most powerful weapons we are likely to possess in the future are super-hydrogen bombs. In a space battle environment, the bombs must be detonated in direct contact with their target to be capable of destroying enemy ships. Space fighters are nimble and can be deployed in large numbers, so sending the fighter fleet in for swarm-like suicide strikes is undoubtedly the best option. Your plan is eminently reasonable. All of your behavior, including trips to Japan, China, and even the mountains of Afghanistan in search of space kamikaze pilots with a spirit of self-sacrifice, and your plan to put the Mosquito fleet under your direct control once that search failed, was also entirely reasonable."
"What's wrong with that?" Tyler asked, sitting up on the sofa.
"Nothing's wrong with that. But that's just the strategy you presented to the outside."
The wallbreaker bent down, drew near to Tyler's ear, and continued speaking in a soft voice.
"Your true strategy had small alterations. For quite a long time, you had me stumped. It was agonizing for me, and I nearly gave up."
Tyler realized that he had a death grip on a sofa handle and tried to relax.
"But then you gave me the key to unlock the whole puzzle. It was such a good fit that for a moment I doubted my good fortune. You know what I'm referring to. Your study of several bodies in the solar system, Europa, Ceres, and the comets. What do they have in common? Water. They all possess water, and in large quantities. On their own, Europa and Ceres have more water than in all of the oceans on Earth. Rabies sufferers fear the water and can go into spasms at the mere mention of the word. I imagine you have similar feelings right now."
The wallbreaker drew close to Tyler and spoke directly into his ear. His breath was not the least bit warm, but felt like a ghostly wind flavored with the grave.
"Water,"
he whispered, as if talking in his sleep.
"Water."
Tyler remained silent, his face like a statue's.
"Is there any need for me to continue?"
the wallbreaker asked, standing up.
"No,"
Tyler said in a low voice.
"But I'll continue anyway,"
the wallbreaker said, almost gleefully.
"I'll leave historians with a complete record, even if history won't endure for much longer. And an explanation for the Lord as well, of course. Not everyone has the keen intellect of the two of us, able to grasp the whole from the merest part. particularly the Lord, who may not even understand a complete explanation.
He raised up a hand, as if to acknowledge the Tri-Solaran listeners, and laughed.
Forgive me.
Tyler's features slackened, and then his bones seemed to melt. He slumped into the sofa. He was finished, and his spirit no longer inhabited his body.
Now then, setting aside the water, let's talk about the mosquito swarm. Its first attack target will not be the Tri-Solaran invaders, but Earth's own space force. This hypothesis is a bit of a reach based on the barest of signs, but I maintain that it is correct. You went around the world seeking to establish a kamikaze force for humanity, but your efforts failed. You anticipated this, but from this failure, you were able to obtain two things you desired. One was total despair in humanity. This you have achieved fully. The second I'll discuss in a moment.
The blade fell. Tyler remained silent, but his spirit had already departed his body.
In other words, the spirit of self-sacrifice you're in search of wouldn't be used to wage war against the Lord, but to murder Earth's entire fleet. In the beginning, your plan didn't include a surprise attack on the main fleet, but after traveling the world, you became utterly disillusioned with modern humanity's dedication. Talking to leaders of the Space Force and veterans of various types of war, you also became convinced that Earth's Space Force did not stand a chance of defeating Tri-Solaris via standard combat. You therefore hatched a strategy even more extreme. In my opinion, this is a very faint hope and an immense risk. Nevertheless, the principles of the Wallfacer Project dictate that in this war, the safest bet is to take a risk. Of course, this was only the beginning. Your betrayal of humanity would be a long process, but you had time on your side. In the following months and years, you were prepared to engineer events that would add to the wall you erected between yourself and the human race. Your despair would gradually grow and your sorrow intensify, and you would leave the human world further and further behind, growing closer and closer to the ETO and Tri-Solaris. In fact, you took your first steps on this road when you urged mercy for the ETO at the PDC hearing not long ago. That wasn't just for show, though. You truly need them to endure. You need members of the ETO to pilot your space fighters in the Doomsday Battle. It is a matter of time and patience, but you would succeed, because the ETO also needs you. It needs your assistance and the resources you possess. It wouldn't be difficult to turn over the Mosquito fleet to the ETO, so long as it was kept a secret from the outside world. And if it were discovered, you could claim that it was all part of the plan.
Tyler did not seem to be listening to the Wallbreaker. He sat on his sofa with his eyes half closed, looking fatigued, as if he had already given up and was beginning to relax.
Very well. Let's talk about the water now. In the Doomsday Battle, the ETO-controlled Mosquito fleet would likely launch a sneak attack on Earth's fleet and then flee to the Lord's fleet. Because they had just demonstrated their disloyalty to Earth, Tri-Solaris might be willing to let them join the fleet, but the Lord would not be so fast to accept the turncoat army. A sufficiently meaningful gift would be required to win them over. What would the Lord need that the solar system possesses? Water. On their 4th century voyage, most of the water in the Tri-Solaran fleet would be used up. As they approached the solar system, dehydrated Trisolarans on board would need to be rehydrated. Since the water used for this would become part of their bodies, clean water would certainly be preferred to the stale water that had been recycled innumerable times on the ship. The Mosquito fleet would offer the Lord an iceberg formed out of huge quantities of water obtained from Europa, Ceres, and the comets. I'm not certain of the specifics. I expect you don't know right now either. But let's say tens of thousands of tons. This giant chunk of ice would be propelled by the engines of all the fighters in the Mosquito group. The Mosquito fleet would likely draw very close to the Lord's fleet when presenting the gift, at which point the second consequence of the failure of your attempt to build a kamikaze force would be put to use. That failure prompted your very logical request for independent control of the entire Mosquito fleet. When Earth's fleet draws close to the Lord's fleet, you would take over control of the fighters from the ETO pilots and switch them to drone mode, ordering the remaining fighters to strike their chosen targets. The super bombs would be detonated at point-blank range, annihilating all of the Lord's ships.
The wall breaker straightened up, and, leaving Tyler's side, approached the floor-to-ceiling windows that overlooked the garden. The hellish wind he had blown into Tyler's ear dissipated, but not before the chill had penetrated his body.
An outstanding plan. That's not a lie. But certain oversights are inexplicable. Why were you so eager to pursue the study of water-bearing heavenly bodies? The technology to extract and transport water in quantity does not exist right now, and engineering side R&D could take years or even decades. Even if you felt you had to start right away, why not toss in a few targets that don't contain water? The moons of Mars, for instance. If you had done so, although it wouldn't have prevented me from eventually exposing your plan, it would have vastly increased the difficulty. How could a great strategist such as yourself overlook such simple tricks?
The wall breaker placed a gentle hand on Tyler's shoulder, and Tyler felt a flash of tenderness, as of an executioner for his victim. He was even a little moved.
Don't beat yourself up. You did well enough, really. I hope history remembers you. And I'm sure they will, as you chose to do one very surprising thing. You resolved to abandon the moral cornerstone of modern society and didn't waver in this resolution from beginning to end. This couldn't have been easy. And while I voice my admiration, at the same time I remind you, what you planned to do is murder.
The wall breaker removed his hand, a flush of restored energy on his formerly wan and sickly face. He stretched out his arms.
Well, Mr. Tyler, I'm done. Call your people.
Tyler, his eyes still shut, said without energy,
"You may leave."
When the wall breaker opened the door, Tyler croaked out a final question.
"If what you say is true, so what?"
The wall breaker turned back toward him.
"So nothing. Mr. Tyler, regardless of whether or not I've broken your plan, the Lord does not care."
Luoji was rendered speechless for a long while after hearing Tyler's account. When an ordinary person spoke with one of them, they would always be thinking, "He's a wall-facer. His words can't be trusted." And those suggestions would present a barrier to communication. But when two wall-facers spoke with each other, the suggestions that existed in both minds cross-multiplied those communication barriers. Such an exchange, in fact, rendered anything either side said meaningless, so that communication itself lost all significance. This was why there had been no private interaction between wallfacers.
How do you evaluate the wallbreaker's analysis?
Luoji asked to break the silence, even though he knew there was no point to the question.
He guessed right, Tyler said.
Luoji wanted to say something, but what? What could be said? They were both wallfacers.
That was my true strategy, Tyler went on.
He evidently had a strong desire to speak, and didn't care whether or not his listener believed him.
Of course, it's still in the preliminary stages. The technology alone is quite difficult. But for me, this was not the biggest blow.
And that was? Luoji felt like a machine for meaningless dialogue.
The day after the Wallbreaker's visit, a complete analysis of my strategy was posted online. The material ran into the millions of words, most of it obtained through Sofon monitoring, and it caused a sensation. The day before yesterday, the PDC called a hearing on the issue, at which it resolved the following. Wallfacer plans may not contain anything that poses a threat to human life. If my plan actually existed, then its execution would be a crime against humanity. It must be stopped, and its wallfacer punished by law. Notice how they invoke crimes against humanity, a term that's being thrown around more than ever these days? But the resolution concluded by saying, according to the basic principles of the Wallfacer Project, the evidence available to the outside world may just be a part of the Wallfacer's strategy of deception and cannot be used to prove that the Wallfacer has actually developed and is executing this plan. So I won't be charged.
I'd thought as much, Luoji said.
But at the hearing, I declared that the Wallbreaker's analysis was correct. I asked to be tried in accordance with national and international law.
I can imagine their reaction.
The PDC's rotating chair and all the permanent member representatives looked at me with that wallfacer smile on their face, and the chair declared the meeting adjourned.
Those bastards.
I know the feeling. I had a total breakdown. I fled out of the hall and into the square outside, shouting, "I am Wallfacer Frederick Tyler. My Wallbreaker exposed my strategy. He was right. I'm going to destroy the Earth fleet. I'm going to use them as quantum ghosts to wage war. I want to kill people. I'm anti-human. I'm a devil. Punish me and kill me."
That was a meaningless act, Mr. Tyler.
What I hate the most is the expression people have when they look at me. A crowd of people surrounded me in the square, their eyes revealing the fantasies of children, the reverence of the middle-aged, and the concern of the elderly. All of their eyes said, "Look, he's a wallfacer. He's at work, but he's the only one in the world who knows what he's doing. See what a great job he's doing? He's pretending so well. How will the enemy know what his real strategy is? That great, great, great strategy that only he knows and will be the salvation of the world. Complete and utter crap. Those idiots."
At last, Luoji decided to remain silent and merely smiled wordlessly at Tyler. As Tyler stared at him, a thin smile wavered on his pale face, and then developed into full-blown hysterical laughter.
"Ha! You're smiling the wallfacer smile! A smile from one wallfacer to another! You think I'm at work! You believe I'm acting the part, and you think I'll save the world!" He cackled again. "How did we end up in such a hilarious situation?"
"This is a vicious cycle we'll never be free of, Mr. Tyler," Luoji said, and sighed softly. Tyler's laughter stopped abruptly.
"Never be free?"
"No, Dr. Luo. There's a way out.
There really is a way, and I'm here today to tell it to you. You need a break. Rest here for a few days, Luochi said. Tyler nodded slowly. Yeah, I need a break. We're the only ones who understand each other's pain, Doctor. That's why I've come. The sun had set a while ago, and the Garden of Eden had grown indistinct in the twilight. This is paradise. Can I go for a walk alone by the lake? You may do whatever you like here. Take it easy, and I'll call you to dinner in a while. They walked down to the lake, leaving Luoji to sit down, sunken in heavy thoughts. For 5 years, he had bathed in an ocean of happiness. The birth of his Xiaxia, in particular, had made him forget everything about the outside world. The love of his wife and child blended together and intoxicated his soul. And, in this gentle home isolated from the rest of the world, he had fallen deeper and deeper into an illusion. Perhaps the outside world really was something akin to a quantum state, and did not exist unless he observed it. But it was a state that could no longer endure, now that the abominable outside world had burst into his Garden of Eden to confuse and frighten him. His thoughts shifted to Tyler, whose last words still resounded in his ears. Was it really possible for Wallfacers to break free of the vicious cycle, to shatter the iron shackles of logic? He jerked to his senses and ran toward the lake. He wanted to shout, but was afraid of scaring Zhuang Yan and Xiaxia, so he just ran as fast as he could through the quiet twilight, the swish of his feet against the grass on the hillside, the only sound. But into this rhythm, a soft crack inserted itself, the sound of a gunshot from the lake. Luoji returned home late that evening after the child was sound asleep. Zhuang Yan asked softly,
Did Mr. Tyler leave?
Yes, he's gone, he said wearily.
He seemed worse off than you.
Yes, that's because he didn't take an easy path. Yan, have you watched TV recently?
No.
She paused, and Luoji knew what she was thinking. With the outside world growing more serious by the day, and the gap widening between life here and life outside, the difference made her uneasy.
Is our life really part of the Wallfacer plan?
She asked, looking at him with that same innocent face. Of course. What is there to doubt?
But can we be truly happy when all of humanity is unhappy?
My love, your responsibility when all of humanity is unhappy is to make yourself happy. With Xiaxia, your happiness gains a point, and the Wallfacer plan gains a point toward its success. Zhuang Yan stared silently at him. The language of facial expressions she had envisioned in front of the Mona Lisa 5 years ago seemed to have been partially realized between her and Luoji. More and more, he could read her mind through her eyes, and what he read now was, How can I believe that? Luoji pondered this for a long time, and finally said, Yan, everything has an ending. The sun and the universe will die one day, so why should humanity believe that it ought to be immortal? Listen, this world is paranoid. Fighting a hopeless war is a fool's errand. So look at the trisolar crisis from a different perspective and leave your cares behind. Not just the ones involving the crisis, but everything else from before that. Use the time that's left to enjoy life. 400 years. Or, if we refuse the doomsday battle, then nearly 500. That's a fair amount of time.
Humanity used the same period to go from the Renaissance to the Information Age, and in the same space could create a carefree, comfortable life. 5 idyllic centuries, without needing to worry about the distant future, where the sole responsibility is to enjoy life. How wonderful! He realized that he had spoken unwisely. Claiming that the happiness of her and the child were part of the plan added another layer of protection to her life by making her happiness into a responsibility. This was the only way to ensure that she maintained a balanced mind in the face of the cruel world. He could never resist her eternally innocent eyes, so he didn't dare look at her when she questioned him. But now, because of the Tyler factor, he had involuntarily told the truth.
"When you say that, are you being a wallfacer?"
she asked. "Yes, of course I am," he said, to fix the situation. But her eyes said, "You really did seem to believe that." UN Planetary Defense Council, Wallfacer Project Hearing, Number 89. At the start of the hearing, the rotating chair spoke to strongly urge that Luoji be required to attend the next hearing, arguing that refusal to participate was not part of the Wallfacer plan because the PDC's supervisory authority over the Wallfacers trumped the Wallfacers' own strategic plans. The proposal was unanimously adopted by all permanent member representatives, and with the emergence of the first Wallbreaker and the suicide of Wallfacer Tyler in mind, the other 2 Wallfacers attending the meeting heard the unspoken implications of the chairman's words. Hines spoke first. His neuroscience-based plan was still in its infancy, but he described the equipment he was envisioning as a basis for further research. He called it the Resolving Imager. Based on computer tomography and nuclear magnetic resonance, it operated by scanning in all cross-sections of the brain at once, which required cross-sectional accuracy on the scale of the internal structure of brain cells and neurons. This would bring the number of simultaneous CT scans to several million, to be synthesized by computer into a digital model of the brain. Other technical requirements were even greater. The scan needed to be conducted at a rate of 24 frames per second to produce a dynamic synthetic model that could capture all brain activity at a neuron-level resolution, making it possible to precisely observe thought activity in the brain, or even replay all neural activity throughout the thinking process. Then Ray Diaz described the progress of his plan. After 5 years of research, the digital star model for super-high-yield nuclear weapons had been completed and was now being thoroughly debugged. Next, the PDC Scientific Advisory Panel presented a report on its feasibility study of the 2 Wallfacers' plans. The advisory panel felt that although there were, in theory, no obstacles to Hines's resolving imager, the technical difficulties far exceeded current conditions, and modern CT scanning was about as far from RI technology as black-and-white film was from modern high-definition cameras. Data processing presented the biggest technical hurdle to the RI device, because scanning and modeling an object the size of the human brain with neuron-level precision required power that was unavailable to modern computers. The obstacle to Ray Diaz's stellar bomb was the same. Present computing power was insufficient. After inspecting the calculations required by the completed portion of the model, the panel's expert group felt that the most powerful of today's computers would take 20 years to model 1/100 of a second of the fusion process. Since the model would need to be run repeatedly in the course of research, practical application was an impossibility. The panel's chief computer scientist said,
"Right now, computer technology based on traditional integrated circuits and von Neumann architecture is nearing the limit of its technological development. Moore's Law is going to collapse. Of course, we can still squeeze out the last few drops of lemonade from these traditional electronic and technological lemons. In our opinion, even given the present declaration in supercomputer progress, the computing power required by the two plans is still achievable. It just requires time. Optimistically, 20 to 30 years. Those goals, if they are reached, will represent the peak of human computing technology, and any further progress will be difficult. With frontier physics under SOFON lockdown, the next-gen and quantum computers that we once dreamed of are now very unlikely to be realized.
We've reached the wall that the SOFONs have erected across our scientific road,
the chair said.
Then there's nothing that we can do for 20 years,
Hines said.
20 years is the most optimistic estimate. As a scientist, you ought to know what cutting-edge research is like.
Then the only thing to do is hibernate and wait the arrival of capable computers,
Ray Diaz said.
I've decided to hibernate too, Hines said.
If that's the case, then I will ask the two of you to greet my successor in 20 years,
the chair said with a smile. The mood of the hearing relaxed. Now that the two wall-facers had decided to enter hibernation, the hearing's participants sighed with relief. The emergence of the first wall-breaker and his wall-facer's suicide had dealt a heavy blow to the entire project. Tyler's suicide, in particular, had been a foolish act. If he had lived, the reality of the Mosquito Swarm plan would forever remain a mystery. His death was tantamount to a final confirmation of the existence of the terrible plan. He had vaulted out of the vicious cycle at the cost of his life, prompting increasing murmurs of criticism of the Wallfacer project among the international community. Public opinion demanded further restrictions on Wallfacer power, but the very nature of the Wallfacer project meant that too many restrictions would make it difficult for the Wallfacers to conduct their strategic deceptions, rendering the entire project meaningless. The Wallfacer project possessed a leadership structure that human society had never before seen, and it required time to adjust and adapt to it. It was clear that the hibernation of the two Wallfacers would provide a buffer period for that to take place. A few days later, in a top-secret underground structure, Ray Diaz and Hines entered hibernation.
Luoji found himself in an ominous dream. He dreamt he was walking the halls of the Louvre. It was a dream he had never had before, because the past 5 years of bliss had given him no cause to dream of previous joys. In this dream, he was alone with the loneliness that had been absent for 5 years. His every footstep reverberated through the palace halls, and something seemed to leave him with every reverberation, until at last he dared not take another step. In front of him was the Mona Lisa. She no longer smiled, but looked on him with compassion in her eyes. When his footsteps stopped, the sound of the outdoor fountains trickled in and gradually grew louder, at which point he awoke to find that the sound was coming from the real world. It was raining. Luoji reached out to hold his beloved's hand and discovered that his dream had become a reality. Zhuang Yan was gone. He rolled out of bed and entered the nursery, where a lamp was softly glowing, but Xia Xia wasn't there. On the little bed, tidily made up, was one of Zhuang Yan's paintings, a favorite of both of theirs. It was practically blank, and from a distance it looked like a sheet of paper. Closer in, you could see fine reeds in the lower left, and in the upper right, the traces of a vanishing goose. In the blank center were two infinitesimally tiny people. But now, a graceful line of text had been added to it. My love,
We're waiting for you at Doomsday. It was bound to happen sooner or later. Could such a dream life last forever? It was bound to happen, so don't worry. You're mentally prepared for it, Luoji told himself. But a wave of dizziness came over him. As he picked up the painting and went toward the living room, his legs quavered and he felt as if he was floating. The living room was empty, but the embers in the fireplace glowed a hazy red that made everything look like melting ice.